Welcome to the Miracle Camp podcast, and thanks for checking out this recording from Man Camp. Please enjoy listening to our speaker from the weekend.
Well, good morning and welcome back. Looks like I didn't scare too many of you away. And you're ready for round two, looking at the life of Elijah. This is one of probably the more well-known stories of the life of Elijah, and also one that's pretty fun to talk about. I will warn you, though, that as we advance in the story tonight and tomorrow, it doesn't always feel like a mountaintop type experience, but we'll go through that session at a time. All right, so before we dive into chapter 18, I just want to do a quick reminder of what happened in chapter 17, because I do think it's important to remember how things build up. So what we looked at really quick last night was that Elijah stepped on the scene boldly, with faith, foundational element of communicating with God in prayer on a regular basis, embedded throughout his story. And he was not afraid, at least didn't seem to be afraid, as he confronted the king and proclaimed that there would be no rain. And then God had him go and hide at a brook, the brook Cherith, where that was an uncomfortable amount of time and a lot of unknowns, and he depended on ravens, unusual, you know, choice. You would think maybe doves, right, in the story of the Bible, but ravens bringing him food, and he's sitting there watching as the drought happens, as the brook is drying up, as water supply is dwindling, and he's still in prayer with God. Are we still doing this? Are we still not sending rain? I'm about to not have water. And he's just waiting and waiting, and then it dries up, and then God does direct him, and that was obviously, as we know, it was part of God's plan, because God directs him to the widow and her son, who were about to die because of the drought, but God supplied for them through miraculous means, endless supply of oil and flour. And then there was the unfair tragedy, the unexpected tragedy, the death of the widow's son. I think some of us can probably relate to a 90-degree turn, unexpected event. Something painful pops up out of left field, so to speak. But then Elijah prays for that, and God intervenes. So all these things are building up. The first resurrection, right, we talked about that last night. All these are building up, and I think it's an important preparation, if so to speak, of Elijah's faith just getting deeper and his relationship with God drawing closer. And then now the time comes for chapter 18. So let's dive in. 1 Kings chapter 18. Verse 1, chapter 18 is long, I will tell you this, so we're going to read a lot of verses and we'll try to get through it. A lot of story here. So, chapter 18, verse 1, after many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go show yourself to Ahab and I will send rain on the earth. Quick pause. After many days, and then it says in the third year. Some commentaries I looked at even said that, you know, well, in Jewish counting of time and calendars, third year, third day, sometimes that could have been like more like a year and a half because you get a part of this year, part of that year. Maybe it wasn't really that long. Maybe it's metaphoric to some degree too. But I don't think that's probably true because James specifically mentions that it was 3.5 years. We looked at that last night. Also, Jesus references it in Luke 4 and says that it was 3 years and 6 months. So I tend to just take it, he says in the third year, 3.5 years, which is hard to wrap your mind around, 3.5 years with no rain, what that would do to a place. Talking about utter devastation. I tried to even Google it. I'm like, what actually happens if you go without rain? You know, it's all kind of just like extrapolations and projections because we're not really sure, but it would be rough, very rough. And then we know it would be because the brook even dried up, right? So he said, go show yourself to Ahab. I will send rain on the earth. So now it's time. Verse 2, so Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. And Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now, parenthetical statement here real quick. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, and when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water. So Obadiah is a servant of God, but he's serving in the palace for Ahab and Jezebel. Verse 5, and Ahab said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys, and perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals. So they divided the land between them and to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. And as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. And Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is it you, my lord Elijah?" He's been missing for 3.5 years, remember? "Is it really you?" And he answered him and said, "It is I. Go tell your lord Ahab, behold, Elijah is here." And he said, "How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord has not sent to seek you." And when they would say, "He's not here," he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, "Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And as soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you, I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab that, and he cannot find you, he will kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth." By the way, has it not been told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And you say, "Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he will kill me." And Elijah said, "As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand," that phrase again, "before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and then Ahab went to meet Elijah. So the famine's very severe. Ahab has been searching and searching, could not find Ahab. God has hid him away very well. But when God said, "Now time's up, let's go tell Ahab, it's time for a rainstorm," Elijah went. He knew, as he told Obadiah here, "Before whom I stand," he's operating now in obedience to God to go back to Ahab. Probably much more scary to go back and face Ahab again than it would have been to stay back at the brook or stay back in Zarephath, right? So that continued cycle of hearing from God and obeying, that is fundamental in Elijah's story. But Obadiah has a struggle here. He's faced with a little bit of a complicated situation. He's already been faithful to serve God in a very godless palace. And he's already trying to figure out how to save prophets that are being slaughtered by Jezebel while also fearing God and saving them. But his appointment appears to be in the palace. And I just think that's an interesting point, that God places and uses people everywhere. You know, sometimes it's easy to put a box and say, "Well, I don't know if God would actually have you go there or do that thing." And this is, I kind of look at this as a spiritual mind your own calling and placement, you know, mind your own business. But God can use people anywhere. He can use you wherever you are, your appointment, your calling, your gifting. He desires to use you, like we asked last night. Does God want to use me? Can he use me? And what is he after? But Obadiah is terrified because he thinks, if I'm going to go tell Ahab you're alive and you're here and then he can't find you because you're really good at hiding, by the way, then I'm next on the chopping block. So Elijah promised and reassured him and said, "I'm not hiding. God has told me to go meet him before whom I stand. I know this authority. I will show myself to him." Obadiah took that at face value. He believed him, and he overcome his fear with faith and obeyed. Overcoming fear, replacing the fear with obedience. The pattern continues. Okay. Next, we look at verse 17. Again, we're just in chapter 18, we're just continuing. Verse 17, when Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" Some verses say troublemaker. And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals." Or in general, the group of idols with Baal and under Baal. Troublemaker, you troubler. That word was used very specifically by Joshua in reference to Achan. Remember Achan? He stole what God said, "Don't take it." He brought it, that brought the sin in the camp, and there was destruction on Israel. That word that Joshua used to describe Achan in what he did that was so evil and brought such destruction to Israel back then was troublemaker. And this is what Ahab uses. He says, you are a troublemaker. You have brought Israel into this destruction. You have brought sin in the camp. You are a troubler. True or false? False. False accusation. You know, those burn. False accusation. It was very pointed and completely untrue. And man, I don't know if you guys have ever experienced that before, but actually just last month at my workplace, I had somebody listed out multiple things they submitted to my supervisor of like, you know, that I create drama and I take credit and I'm a hostile work environment. Like all these things, it didn't even make sense. Like, where is it coming from? Thankfully, my supervisor told me, he said, you don't even have to try to defend these things. Like, we know you've been here. We know you. But it was very uncomfortable. And it hit hard because I'm like, you know, that's not the kind of character that I want to portray God well everywhere I go. But still, even though you know it's not true, it just, right? It hurts. It's really hard to stay in a place of peace. But I think the key is Elijah's response. He says, I haven't, you have. His response was because he knew. It's not true. I'm standing before the Lord. I'm obeying God. I'm not going to believe this false accusation. And in fact, he does a 180 with it, very similar to the prophet Nathan. Remember when he tells the story to King David after his sin with Bathsheba, and then he said, but you're the man. He turns and says, you're the man. You're the one, because you have followed idolatry. You have abandoned the Lord. And I think just maybe, Ahab's response in this particular scene is what escalated what was about to be a rainstorm into a firestorm. Because now we're not just going to send rain, we're going to have a display of power. And so Elijah's response, verse 19, he's continuing to talk to Ahab, and he says, now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Whew. Here, the odds don't matter when it's God, right? God's with me. It doesn't matter who's against me. And there's 850 false prophets being hosted daily, celebrated, welcomed in the palace. I can only imagine why Obadiah is so grieved and so conflicted with like fear in this moment. That idolatry, the extreme commitment to this and devotion is just significant. Nearly 1,000 people. But Elijah makes a good point here. He says, not only gathering those false prophets, but also gather all Israel. It's important that what we're about to do is a public display. It's essential for Israel to buy in and be a witness to what's about to happen. Continuing verses 20 through 24. So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping or hesitating or halting between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. So Elijah here, he's setting some definitions. He's making a very clear challenge, and he's setting some definitions. And he tells them, how long will you waver between two opinions? Again, going back to Joshua, where he told the people, you know, choose you this day who you will serve. Choose you this day who you will serve. And the people didn't answer. They're very conflicted. They're very double-minded. That's where a lot of you see the idolatry is like a both-and thing a lot of times. And he's like, choose. Like, they can't both be God. Pick one and follow him. How about we set it up? Let's Let's offer the true God an opportunity to respond with power, and then we'll know. And this is because Elijah, serving God, knows God is not going to share his throne with Baal, right? God is a holy and jealous God, and the people are conflicted, and they're trying to appease and follow two, the halting or the wavering or the limping between two. And it's interesting how Elijah says, I alone am left as a prophet of God. He knows Obadiah exists, and Obadiah also saved 100 prophets, so he knows there's other prophets there. But in this particular setting, he's saying, hey, it's me and you. I am here alone before God. You guys have hundreds. So let's do this. So he's standing there in boldness, alone, not afraid to take up the challenge or to lay down the challenge. And the people agreed to this term. They said it is well spoken. And I think this is an important element that Elijah didn't proceed directly into some display of power. You know, he could have said right here, right now, we don't even need to go to Mount Carmel. Boom. Like lightning, whatever, fire, zap, let's go. Save some time. Let's be efficient. But it was very important that they understood, what are we going to go see? Why are we here? What are we after? What are we looking for to see happen? And how will we know what it means? So he established these terms. Established the meaning. And the false prophets also seemed to agree. I think they probably thought they had a chance. You know, remember the magicians in Pharaoh's court? They were able to do a lot of cool stuff. They were able to deceive people. They were able to do some magic tricks. There is a system of darkness. You know, I don't think it's something we have to be super afraid of as Christians, but I think we got to be aware that we have an enemy, and he likes to do tricky things, and he deceives people, and he lies, and he works in charades and shadows. And I think these prophets thought, well, you know, maybe we get to keep our little illusions going. But Elijah set it up, following God, that it was clear that everything that was about to happen was going to be outside of human control. There was going to be fire falling from heaven to confirm who God was, and that was going to be outside of human control. And this, I think, just points to Elijah's complete dependence on God to show up. You know, he's following God, and he's setting up this challenge, but you got to realize, like, at a certain point, like, God, you are going to send the fire, right? Like, if you go up there, and we've got hundreds of prophets of Baal, we've got all Israel gathered, Ahab's here, he's probably got a sword on his hip, right? And we're going to be up there, and I'm going to be calling, and if you don't show up, if you don't send fire, I am cooked. He's put everything on the line. He's risked it all. Complete dependence and commitment to God. In 2 Chronicles 16:9, we read that last night, God is looking to show himself strong, and I believe Elijah knew this, and he's following in step and in alignment with God. And this bold obedience that Elijah is now displaying to follow God had to happen before God sent the fire. Right? Elijah had to set the challenge. He had to be willing to risk it all and put it on the line and go to Mount Carmel and see what was going to happen. And then God sent the fire. It's a sequence. And Elijah was intent on this, almost like a military style objective of focus and commitment to God. And he didn't want to just tell them about God. They'd heard about it. He wanted to show them. And that requires risk. You know, if you want to really show people who God is, you got to do something outside of the normal human element. Not necessarily performing healings and miracles. I just mean like faith that affects you. Faith that changes you. Obedience that's uncomfortable. Something that's vulnerable. Show people how God is real. Reminds me of a story. I think I mentioned to you guys that we moved to Fort Wayne after the job change. My brook dried up there in Michigan, and God directed us to Fort Wayne, and we moved there in 2020, back when COVID was first starting. And God established there a great place for us. We were very comfortable, great job, great house, great community, great church, all that stuff. But after just a year, We had the opportunity to go and move as a family to the Dominican Republic to lead a therapeutic boarding school for troubled youth. And that's something that we had always kind of longed to do, is be in missions and in ministry. We checked it out, looked into it, seemed like an awesome opportunity, so we went. We signed up, we sold everything, and we moved to the campus in the Dominican Republic, and we're there running and leading the campus. It really was amazing. I have a lot of beautiful pictures and a lot of great memories of what God was doing and of how we were able to be a part of that community as a family. What we didn't know is that shortly after we arrived, there would be a change in the leadership in the organization back stateside, and that new CEO then would require a lot of different things that directly affected the campus. Impossible standards to meet, impossible timelines, and just kind of manipulated the whole situation into where they ended up deciding to sell the campus, which is fine. The organization has the right to do it, but the way it was done was really difficult. Didn't feel very honest a lot of times. And our long-term dream turned into something very short-term and very abrupt. And I remember, after just being there for 14 months, having to help the students all find another place to go and help the staff all find another place to go, and we were some of the last ones to leave, kind of the dirty side of being a leader, sometimes the dirty work, right? But we go to leave, and it just felt like a graveyard. It was dark. 50 acres of beautiful campus now was dark and empty. Felt like a cemetery, and we were just all so upset. And we came back. We were flying back to Fort Wayne with nothing but suitcases. And I think that moment is probably one of the most acute moments I've ever had in my life of feeling helpless. I feel like, God, you got to show up. Like Elijah, put it all on the line. God, I put it on the line. I need you to show up, or we are cooked. We are going back to what? I don't have a home there. I don't have a job there. I don't know what we're doing. I'm supposed to be taking care of my family. I'm helpless. My family is helpless. We're completely dependent on you to show up. Continue that in a minute. All right, we'll go back to chapter 18, verse 25. So the people have agreed. The people have agreed to the challenge, and off they head to Mount Carmel. Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first. For you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it, and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." Sorry, make sure I'm finding my place here. "O Baal, answer us," but there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped or leaped around the altar that they had made. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. Wow. So they've engaged in the challenge. They've got the bull, they've set it up, they put the altar there. And from morning until noon, so for several hours, from morning until noon, they are dancing basically around their altar, crying out and asking Baal to please show up. But there was no response, nothing, after hours of this. And they start getting desperate, and Elijah starts mocking them. It's a very interesting scene, but I think it probably shows the confidence that Elijah had. He knew God was powerful enough to send the fire, and that God was also powerful enough to make sure the fire didn't come prematurely. He knew what was about to happen. And so he's mocking the powerlessness of the prophets, because really, he's mocking Baal. and say, he is not going to answer you. And he gives some really funny examples. Oh, he's probably using the bathroom, or maybe he's taking a nap. Is that the kind of God you want to serve, by the way? Is the God that's going to ignore you in your desperation, the God who's going to be timing out on you? No. And you know, this made me pause and think, and I'm thinking about idolatry, and I'm like, yeah, you guys seen the misery that idolatry brings people? Whether it's addiction to sin or it's whatever it is, maybe something in your own life that's put you, that you've erected between you and God, and it's just misery. It doesn't satisfy. It doesn't answer. It doesn't fulfill. And there's just this continued desperation because nothing outside of God will satisfy. And this one foot in each world, Baal and God, is the one with the most desperate, most misery, most miserable situation. And this frenzied worship or desperation that they are now doing, this display, it says they're cutting themselves as was their custom. So this is not a new thing, but they didn't start with the cutting, right? They started with the yelling and the screaming and the praying or whatever they're doing, but as they get more and more desperate and there's no response, they try to manipulate their God into a response through their own destruction. And you know, I've seen that in the church, where we get so legalistic and bound up with stuff that we cause pain to ourselves or one another, and we think that if I am in enough pain, if I am in enough just misery, then I'll get God's attention. But that's not how it works. Thankfully, we do not have to cause ourselves pain and misery to manipulate a response from God. But religion often does promote punishment of self to gain favor. But that's not the way of grace. That was free. All right, moving on. So verse 29, he says, as midday passed, so they continued until the time of the oblation. That was an early evening offering. So now they've gone from morning until noon, and then Elijah mocks them, and then they continue until basically dinner time. So hours and hours and hours, there's been ample opportunity for a response. And after this extreme amount of time has passed, then I love how it's emphasized three times. There was no voice, no answer, no one paid attention. There wasn't even a little echo out there. There was nothing, not a flicker, whimper, or whisper out there, not a spark, coldness, darkness, not a response. Utter failure. The false prophets, in their hours and hours of begging and pleading and dancing and cutting in desperation, got zero reciprocity. Very different than what happened just last night when we looked at Elijah and how he prayed and he said, God, God, I've never seen it done before, but I just believe that you're strong enough and you care enough that you can return a life into a body. And God listened to the voice of Elijah and the life returned to the widow's son. That is relationship. That is faith. Prayer response. That's not what the prophets of Baal are experiencing at all. They get nada. So, we'll move along. See what happens next. Verse 30. Then Elijah said to all the people. So then, after all this, Elijah said, time's up. Come near to me. And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. And Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, Israel shall be your name. And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. Pause there real quick. So this is where Elijah says, okay, my turn, God's turn. Let's change focus. And the first thing he does after calling the people's attention is he's repairing an altar of the Lord that had been broken down. And he's taking the stones and he's building it back. And what is that? It's such a clear, call to Israel to remember their heritage, to recall their identity. Your name is Israel because of God. That's who you are. That's who you're supposed to be. You're supposed to have a relationship with God. You're supposed to know who He is. Let's repair. Let's get back to the basics. Let's remember our identity, our heritage. He repaired the altar of the Lord, and then he got ready. And he is reminding the people, you're supposed to be a people of God. And we already, from the very beginning, see here a completely different attitude. It's not frenzied. It's not desperate. It's honoring. It's confident. It's worshipful. Verse 33. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill four jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. You know, we saw up here in the game that how many of us have started a campfire, and I'm pretty sure you wouldn't start with fire, with water. You know, that's just not how I would do it. I don't put the water on it and then say, okay, now I think that's enough water, let's light it. But this is not a human bonfire, right? This is going to be a different one. This is going to be one from heaven. So, and I think that's important because Elijah here is underlining the divine element. He's saying, I'm going to soak it. I'm not doing some little sleight of hand trick, a little flame under the corner. No, I'm soaking it. There's going to be no doubt that when this thing is on fire, it's from God. Also very interesting that he soaks it with that much water, which is a very precious substance at the time. There's a major, major drought. But he's not worried because he's like, they're about to have a lot more water coming down here, guys. First the fire, then the water. So they pour it with water all around. It also reminds me of how sometimes in my life, I've tried to help God out a little bit. You know, I'm like, God, I know you're going to send the fire, but I'm just going to put some fire nearby. Or I'm going to put some real dry leaves here. I'll just, you know, a little thunderstorm might, a little lightning, you know. But he left the divine element to God. He wanted it to be so clear that God was the one that was going to respond. And he wanted that line to be clear. He's like, God, I am following you boldly in obedience up to this line, and then I am depending on you to respond. I'm not going to play God, and I'm not asking you to play Elijah. I'm going to be in alignment with you, and then I'm going to wait for you. And he understood that. And I think that knowing that gives us a boldness in our faith and in our obedience. Verse 36. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Elijah is praying for three things. He said, please let it be known this day. A loud announcement or proclamation. Let it be known. Three things. A vindication for God, that you are God, the God of Israel. You are the true King and Lord. And secondly, personal vindication. I am your servant. This isn't about me. I am your servant, but also I am your servant. And third, for Israel, revival, that you have turned their hearts back. Almost, he's saying it like it's already would have happened, like you've already started turning their hearts back. So he's asking for God's glory, his personal affirmation as his prophet, and for Israel, his people, to return back to him. Which brings us again to this whole purpose. What is God after? What is God trying to do? Why has there been a drought? Why all these things have happened? Why are we at Mount Carmel now? Why have we just watched the false prophets dance around for hours, bleeding? Why? For this purpose, that God would be known and that the hearts of his people would be turned to him. Now it gets good. Verse 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. It's not just a little bit, a little flame, a little flicker. No, and also they didn't have to wait for hours until the next day or later that night. It was God was eager to answer. He was eager to respond. And he sent a massive, massive flame that consumed everything. The bull, the wood, the stones, the dirt around it, the dust, the water, all that water, all completely gone. Not halfway. Not a little bit. Completely. It was above and beyond statement of power. He wanted to make it so clear that he is the one and only true God of Israel. He left no doubt. And how did the people respond? Verse 39. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal, let none of them escape." And they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. The proclamation of faith. God answered Elijah's requests. He not only sent the fire, but in sending the fire, he answered his three requests. The people understood. You're God. We need to turn to you. Elijah's your man. And they repeated it twice for emphasis and sincerity. The Lord, He is God. There was no doubt at all as to what happened or how to interpret it, because Elijah had clearly established the definitions and the terms. He had belabored the point, what they're going to do, how they're going to do it, and what the response is supposed to look like, and they understood that. And then, for good measure, they went ahead and killed all the false prophets. God is a jealous God. He wants to be Lord. He was eager to prove Baal wrong. He was eager to turn his Israel's hearts back to him. And I think God is just as jealous for our hearts today to remember to keep him first, one and only, in our heart, in our home, in our community, in our country. He is first. Okay, next scene. Continued divine confirmation. Verses 41 to 46. All right, after all that happened, then Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there is a sound of the rushing of rain." So Ahab went up to eat and to drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bowed himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, "Go up now, look toward the sea." And he went up and looked and said, "There's nothing." And he said, "Go again," 7 times. And at the 7th time, his servant said, "Behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising from the sea." And he said, "Go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down, lest the rain stop you." And in a little while, the heavens grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah. And he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. I love this because it's continued divine confirmation. God didn't just send the fire and stop. No, the whole thing started with saying, "Hey, I'm going to send rain." And God didn't forget that promise. And Elijah didn't forget it either. And he's standing there after this happened with the fire. And he's like, "I hear rain." I don't know how he heard that. That's just a hearing of faith, or if that was prophetic in some way. But there's no rain yet. But God hasn't forgot his promise, and neither has Elijah. And he starts praying. And as we talked about last night, there's always a need to pray. Elijah has seen God act in incredible ways. He has seen God show up. He knows that God has promised that there's going to be rain now. He just sent fire. There's no reason to doubt it. He could have just gone home and said, "Now it's going to rain." No, he starts praying. And he prays for the rain. And there's nothing. But he's like, "I can hear it." So he prays again. And he prays again. 7 times he's praying, and he's sending his servant. Say, "Is it raining yet? Do you see anything yet?" And finally, after the 7th time of him praying earnestly and sending his servant, there's a little cloud. I think it's interesting because in the scene we just had was God responding with massive fire, right? And then this time it starts just a little cloud. It's like, We can't put God in a box. We know what he's going to do some ways, but he starts with a little cloud. And Elijah's like, that's enough. Let's go. I believe it. We're ready. And then the heavens did grow black with clouds. One of the biggest, probably, thunderstorms or rainstorms ever in history, after the longest drought probably ever in history. Never, ever give up praying. You know, even in the light of a promise, even in the light of God maybe answering one prayer, but maybe there's another one still out there. I just want to encourage you guys today, like, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes we feel like, well, I already prayed once, what am I supposed to do? In this story, it's like God is inviting us. Keep praying. Stay in communication with me. Not just like checking a box, sending a request, but like stay in there. Stay with me. Kind of like Jesus asked the disciples, tarry, stay with me, pray with me. Exercise your faith. And then at the very end, after all that was said and done, Elijah outruns the horses. We looked at last night, the on the map, from Mount Carmel to Jezreel was 20 miles. I just think that's hilarious. That Elijah probably ran the fastest marathon. Usain Bolt had nothing on him. You know, in Isaiah, we quote the verse about mounting up with wings as eagles, but maybe sometimes we need to run with the legs of Elijah. You know, and he was ready. And he ran. And he ran all the way back to Jezreel and beat Ahab there. And I think we'll look at it tonight. He probably had some expectations about what God was doing there too and what God was about to do. But before we get into ahead of ourselves, I'll go back to my story. And you know, I know it's not the same. And I think it's important that we somehow find parallel between some of these stories that are so powerful and miraculous and unique to how they apply to us today. Because I don't know about you, but I've never called down fire from heaven. I don't think I've even asked before. And so what does that mean to us? Like, how do we connect to that? How do we take this story home? How do we receive it? And that's why I shared that story of saying, man, sometimes though, I bet you guys know a time when you were flat on your back or you had your back against the wall and you were just like, I got nothing. I'm trying, I'm believing, I'm obeying, but really I got nothing and I need God to show up. And that's why I shared that story, because in my mind, that's how I would connect to this. I'm like, God, I need you to show up. I need a divine element here. The human is not enough. And you know what? I returned, and I realized later, maybe I'll throw up some pictures just because it might help you connect to it, but I thought about it too late in the slideshow where you would see photos of our family there and how it looked so beautiful, and then at the end where we're all lined up with our suitcases. But we did see God show up. It was not easy, but we flew back to the States, and there were a couple different churches in Fort Wayne that had housing available, and we were able to stay in housing for over a year as I searched for a job, and within a few months was able to get the job I have now, and we were able to then buy a home, and God helped us get back on our feet and rebuild it. And through that, there were a lot of things that happened. The generosity of other people, they're welcoming and they're supporting us that we wouldn't have experienced otherwise. Remember the John Beatitude? Fat, happy, and healthy, then we don't need God. You know, when you need God and you see him show up, but also you see his people. And that's something that's humbling, but it's also something that is really awesome. And sometimes, you know, we get real and raw with reality and with faith, and we see God show up. And what happened is that and we made our faith real, and our kids got to see that, and they walked it with us, and they saw that we didn't have answers to some questions that they had or we had. But we prayed together for a job, for a house, for community, for healing, because we were dealing with a lot of grief. And we're like, Lord, we need to process that, and then we need a new dream. We don't know what to do now. But I will tell you that in making faith real, in taking our request to God and seeing how he responded and how he answered, that how that built the faith of us, me and my wife, but also of our kids. And they saw God show up in some awesome ways. And it reminds me of what John says. He says, I have no greater joy than to see my children walk in the truth. And I will tell you, it hurts. I think probably the deepest, deepest pain I've experienced in my life so far has been looking in the eyes of my own kids in pain and wondering even if their pain was somewhat my fault because I took them there in the first place. And I can't fix it. Flip side of that, deepest joy is when they cry out in faith and God answers. Those are inseparable, right? It's like kind of like good and bad, but it's together. And I just think that's the reality. That's like the guts of life that we sometimes wrestle with. And I just want to encourage you in your life and in the people around you, be real with it. Let your faith be real and let it impact you. John Maxwell, I referenced him last night too. He says, don't curse the darkness, turn on the light. And oh, yeah, makes sense. You know, turn on the light. Let your faith be real. All right, so as we go into closing, I have some questions here, but a couple quick points. You know, I think sometimes we read different stories in the Bible and we think, I want to do that. I want to call down fire from heaven. Or I want to do that. I want to be able to walk by in my shadow, heal people like Peter's. That'd be cool. And it would be. But you know what happened is chapter 17 happened before chapter 18. And I think sometimes we want to see the awesome sauce, but we are not sure about that practical daily obedience and prayer and faith. And I just want to encourage you, not out of a place of guilt or embarrassment, but like, let's also live chapter 17. Let's also be okay with wrestling with the things that are uncomfortable, with stepping out. Jesus said, be faithful in the little, then you be faithful in the much. It's almost like a spiritual order of operations, right? Like, be faithful, pray, step out in faith, obey, let God do what he's going to do. And that'll build. It's like the old hymn that says, trust and obey. It may be simple, but it's not easy. But God wants to use us, and it starts today. It starts at my home. It starts at my work, on my couch, wherever I go. Trust and obey. Make my faith real. All right, questions. Do you have a personal Mount Carmel moment in your life? And what I mean by that is when you put it all on the line for God, and how did he show up? How do you maintain a holy jealousy for God in your heart and life? Where could you exercise greater trust instead of trying to help God out? What steps can you take to build a stronger and more persistent prayer life? Finally, how can you invite God to show up with power in an area in your life where you need it most? Like I said, these are suggestions. You can use other ones. I just want you guys to get into your groups after this, and we have a few minutes before lunch. And you can discuss these things and pray for one another. And then we go into lunch, but honestly, the conversation can continue at lunch, right? We can just keep going. So I'm going to pray, and you guys will be dismissed and to your groups, and then after that to lunch. Lord Jesus, thank you so much for your faithfulness. Thank you that you did not leave Elijah hanging. You sent your fire. And thank you that you do not leave us hanging either. You respond. You call us to participate with you. You use us because you're after our hearts. Thank you, Lord, that you are the one and only true God, and we seek to honor you with our lives. We ask that you will show us how to offer our daily life to you in obedience and in worship. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening to this chapel session and for diving into Scripture with us. We hope you've been encouraged in your walk with Jesus, and we hope to see you here at camp for next year's Man Camp. So, thanks again, and have a great rest of your day.